ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। Reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam. This is Canto 7, Chapter 6, Text Number 9. Kaha Griheshu Puman Saktam Atmanam Ajita Sneha Pashai Dridhai Badam Utsaheta Vimochitum. Ko Griheshu Puman Saktam Atmanam Ajitindriya Sneha Pashad Vidar Badam Utsaheta Vimochitam Ko Griheshu Puman Saktam Atmanam Ajitindriya Sneha Pashad Vidar Badam Utsaheta Vimochitam Ko Griheshu Puman Saktam Atmanam Ajitindriya Sneha Pashad Vidar Badam Utsaheta Vimochitam. Please chant. Ladies, please. Word by word meanings. Kaha what graheshu to household life puman man saktam very much attached atmanam his own self the soul sorry let's do that again his own self the soul ajita indriya who has not conquered the senses, sneha pashai, by the ropes of affection, dridaya, very strong, badam, bound hand and foot, utsaheta, is able, vimuchitam, to liberate from material bondage. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. Translation. What person, too attached to household life due to being unable to control his senses, can liberate himself? An attached householder is bound very strongly by the ropes of affection for his family, wife, children, and other relatives. Purport. Let's do it together. What person too attached to household life due to being unable to control his senses can liberate himself? An attached householder is bound very strongly by ropes of affection for his family, wife, children, and other relatives. Purport. Prahlad Maharaj's first proposal was Gomara Achare Pragyo Dharman Bhagavatan Tha. Quote, one who is sufficiently intelligent should use the human form of body from the very beginning of life, in other words, from the tender age of childhood, to practice the activities of devotional service, giving up all other engagements. Dharman Bhagavatan means the religious principle of reviving our relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. For this purpose, Krishna personally advises Sarva dharman parityajya mam ekam sharanam vraja. Give up all other duties and surrender unto me. While in the material world, we manufacture so many duties in the name of so many isms, but our actual duty is to free ourselves from the cycle of birth, death, old age, bondage, and especially from household life. Household life is actually a kind of license for a materially attached person by which to enjoy sense gratification under regulative principles. This is what differentiates household life in the material world without the Vedas, but with the Vedic teachings, it means under regulative principles. It means that you can't be an animal. It means that you have to be controlled. It means you have to be disciplined. You have to be regulated. And there should be a proper philosophy and understanding accompanying all sense pleasure. One must know that eventually I have to give this up. That way, there is a goal, there is a direction. And while one has, as it mentions here, the license to enjoy, one has to understand that it can only lead to deeper and deeper misery if one does not counteract this tendency with other practices, such as those practices which lead to devotional love for the Supreme Lord. Otherwise, there is no need of entering household life. Before entering household life, one should be trained as a brahmachari, living under the care of the guru, whose place is known as the Gurukula. Of course, here we have also we have brahmacharinis who are trained similarly. I think there is some training going on now, isn't it? Isn't there a program now? I thought I heard in one of the classes that some of the ladies who are living in the ashram have some regular training going on. Brahmachari Guru Kule Vasandanto Gurur Hitam from the Bhagavatam 7.12.1. From the very beginning, a brahmachari is trained to sacrifice everything for the benefit of the guru. A brahmachari is advised to go begging alms door to door, addressing all women as what?
Mother.
Yes, as mother. And whatever he collects goes to the benefit of the guru. In this way, he learns how to control his senses and sacrifice everything for the guru. When he is fully trained, if he likes, he is allowed to marry. Thus, he is not an ordinary grihastha who has learned only how to satisfy his senses. A trained grihastha can gradually give up household life and go to the forest to become increasingly enlightened in spiritual life and at last take sannyas. The reason for this is he's learned how to become selfless. He's learned how to deny himself and remain peaceful and calm, controlled, whereas an ordinary person has not learned that. And therefore, the idea of leaving family or children or business is unthinkable because his whole identity is connected with his body. And he has not learned how to really control or discipline his body, so that ultimately he can remove his body from his attachments and moorings. A trained grihastha can gradually give up household life and go to the forest to become increasingly enlightened in spiritual life, and at last take sannyas. Prahlad Maharaj explained to his father that to be freed from all material anxieties, one should go to the forest. Hitvatma patam graham andhakupam. One should give up his household, which is a place for going further and further down into the darkest region of material existence. The first advice, therefore, is that one must give up household life, graham andhakupam. However, if one prefers to remain in the dark well of household life because of uncontrolled senses, he becomes increasingly entangled by ropes of affection for his wife, children, servants, house, money, and so on. Such a person cannot attain liberation from material bondage. Therefore, children should be taught from the very beginning of life to be first-class brahmacharis. Then it will be possible for them to give up household life in the future. The problem is that the more one enjoys himself, whether it's for food, whether it's for different objects that one may give each other in household life, whether it's clothing, whether it's the apartment, as we become more entangled or involved in household life, we become more and more attached to these items. Now, attachment doesn't mean, for example, yeah, I have my hand on this book, so I can take my hand off. So, obviously, my hand is not attached to the book. But if I have some very strong glue on my hand, and I put my hand on the book, I may have to pull and pull and pull, and maybe I'll get it off, and maybe not. And if you have cement on your hand, forget it. It's not going to come off. It's going to stay stuck to the book. And that's the way household life is being described here, because there are so many different pleasures in household life, and there are so many different miseries in household life. But we tend to disregard or not be concerned about the miseries, and just think about the pleasures, and because those pleasures are there and give us a sense of so-called being, a sense of identity, I get this pleasure, I have this pleasure, I'm a person, I'm important, because I get these pleasures, I have status in the world, all these things tend to mislead and misguide us. To return home, back to Godhead, one must be completely free from material attachment. Therefore, bhakti yoga means vairagya vidya. Vairagya means detachment. Vairagya vidya, the art that can help one develop a distaste for material enjoyment. Vasudeve Bhagavati Bhakti Yoga Prayojitaha Janayatyashu Vairagyam Jnanam Cha Yad Ahaitukum Kam. Quote, by rendering devotional service unto the personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, one immediately acquires causeless knowledge and detachment from the world. That's from the Bhagavatam 1.2.7. If one engages in devotional service from the beginning of life, he easily attains vairagya vidya, or asakti, detachment, and becomes jitendriya, the controller of his senses. One who perfectly engages in devotional service is therefore called Goswami, or Swami, master of the senses. Unless one is master of the senses, he should not accept the renounced order of life, sannyas. A strong inclination for sense enjoyment is the cause of the material body. We want to keep enjoying, 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 enjoying through this body, notwithstanding that there are so many difficulties, problems, trials. Quite often, one does not even connect those difficulties and troubles and trials to the excess of material sense pleasure. It's as if one is on one side and one is on the other side, and there's no bridge connecting them. But actually, there is, as I'll get into a little bit. A strong inclination for sense enjoyment is the cause of the material body. Without full knowledge, one cannot be unattached to material enjoyment. But as long as one is not in that position, one is not fit to return home back to Godhead. So detachment is being very strongly recommended here. Om Agina Timirandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Unmalitam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha. I was born in the darkness of ignorance, and my spiritual master opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge. I offer my humble obeisances unto his lotus feet. So here we have Srila Prabhupada banging away at material life, and particularly household life. Not that he's showing any hostility towards it. He recognizes the fact that it, in many cases, or I should say in most cases, it's quite necessary. People want a certain amount of sense pleasure. As we grow up, especially in the Western world, we're flooded with sense pleasure. And we get used to sense pleasure. So it becomes a habit. And that which becomes a habit, as we know, becomes a tendency. And what becomes a tendency becomes a characteristic, and what becomes a characteristic becomes our destiny. So our destiny is made by what we do every moment, every second. This, along with the destiny that we made in the past, which is manifesting as our current karma or karmic reactions. Therefore, it becomes very important that in early life, as Prahlad Maharaj is saying here, the true goal of life, which is not exercise or stimulation of the senses, the eyes, the ears, the nose, the tongue, the skin, the genitals, it's not stimulation of the mind, the imagination, the memory, It's not stimulation of the intelligence with respect to material sense objects. The goal of life, the true goal of life, as Srila Prabhupada is saying so many times here, the true goal of life is God realization. And taking it a little bit further, beyond just knowing that I am a spirit soul and I have a relationship with the Supreme Lord, and my business is to resurrect that my consciousness of that relationship, beyond that, it is not merely self-realization, but it is also love of the Supreme One, the Supreme God. It is this love that gives us the inner pleasure, the inner joy, the inner satisfaction. If it is simply, I know that I am the soul, I know you're a soul, I know that the super soul is within me, within you, within every atom of creation. If it is just that and nothing more, then that is limited. And the most we can hope for in that situation is to possibly the four different kinds of liberation, such as having this sarupya, having the same body as the Lord, or having living in the same planet as the Lord, having great opulence like the Lord, and having a friendly association to the Lord. But this, in these states, this should not be minimized or ignored or even discounted. It is also a great position to have, to be in the eternal world, to be with the Lord and expressing one's devotional service to the Lord with love in one's heart. But there is still higher, and Srila Prabhupada emphasizes that, especially in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, and that's why he calls it the postgraduate course of self-realization or bhakti yoga. In that situation, one does not stop at merely glorifying, adoring, applauding, celebrating the Lord. But one desires to have within his heart a very close, a very intimate, a very solid, deep, as Prabhupada says, a very packed up relationship with the Supreme Lord. He wants to be with the Lord. He wants to look at the Lord. He wants to look at His beautiful eyes, beautiful lips, beautiful smile. He wants to hear His delightful speech. He wants to watch Him walk. He wants to watch Him as He looks at the different animals and how the animals, the deer, they come around Him. He wants to look at the beautiful peacock feather. He wants to listen to the sound of His flute. Wants to see the relationship between him and Mother Yashoda and Nanda Maharaj. Wants to see the relationship between Krishna and his cowherd boyfriends. He wants to be a part of all this because it's so delightful. It's so delicious. This comes from making intense effort to develop love of the Lord. We have a natural tendency to love. That is our nature. The question is, what to love? Who to love? So many people, they love their dogs, they love their cats, they love their turtles, they love their husband, they love their wife. And what happens is that quite often, as a result of this love, as we learn from the story of Bharat Maharaj, if the last thought in your mind when you die is your turtle or your dog, or you're a goldfish, well then there's a good chance that you may come back as a goldfish. Unfortunate as that may be. Does anybody here want to come back as a goldfish? So it's an unfortunate situation. And people are in ignorance of this. That's why this book that we have, which is Coming Back, which Drudha Karma was a part of the producing of that book. Very, very wonderful and great book. I give it to many persons who know nothing about Krishna consciousness and have no idea of the future of what they could come back to. In fact, I gave one recently to an aunt of mine who has no knowledge whatsoever. And she thanked me very much for the book and thought it was very stimulating, very interesting, something she had never even can imagine before. So that's why it's so important that people ideally stay in the human form of life. Because it is only in the human form of life that we can truly progress and advance and move forward and upward into the higher regions of spiritual joy and happiness. It's very important that this happen. So what Srila Prabhupada often mentions is that we should repose our love solely and only in Krishna. So sometimes people say, you mean I can't love my mother? I can't love my father? I can't love my dog? Is that what you people are about? That sounds impersonal. No, we're not about that at all. Actually, you'll come to love them more if you first love Krishna intensely, exclusively, solely, overpoweringly. If you love Krishna in that manner, then you automatically love all persons, places, things which are connected with Krishna. And that's everything. So, but it will be a different kind of love. It will not be an attached love. It will not be a demanding love. Like, I love you, now you got to love me back. Hey, I gave you a gift for your birthday, but you didn't give me anything. Or you feel upset, you feel disturbed. Sometimes that happens in family life. Husband forgets it's his wife's birthday. God forbid that should happen. But it does. And then, you know, day goes by, you know, morning, wake up, no happy birthday. He's got anxieties, he's about to lose his business, and he's not thinking of that. And then he comes home, and no flowers in his hand, no happy birthday. So his wife thinks, what's going on? Is he having an affair outside or something going on? So, therefore she feels very upset, as if she's uncared for. She goes to her friend, tells her friend on the phone, she says, I don't know, maybe I'm losing him. But it really has nothing to do with that. It's just his mind was just flooded with all kinds of confusions and uncertainties and desires to get his business in order and so forth. And then finally, when they're sitting down to dinner, she goes, and he looks up. She says, aren't you forgetting something? He's forgetting something? Aren't you forgetting something? Oh, yes, it's your birthday. Happy birthday. I'm so sorry, honey. Please forgive me. It's terrible. I am ashamed of myself. And then he explains all the reasons and so forth. So what I'm trying to bring out is that when there's this attachment, you see, these emotions come which really are totally unnecessary. A person who is Krishna conscious would think, well, maybe he's got something else on his mind. Maybe I can help him. Because the person is selfless. When you're selfless, you're concerned about other selves. That's the nature of selflessness. You're not so concerned about yourself, what you're getting, what you're receiving, how people are applauding you or greeting you. Those things are not so important. So the important point is that if we give our love solely and exclusively to the Supreme Lord, to Krishna, since everyone is like a ray of the light of the Supreme Lord, how can I not love everything and everyone everywhere? It's not possible. I may dislike some of the things they do, which is contradictory to the instructions and laws of Krishna. But I don't dislike the person. Because the person, the soul, and I, the person, the soul, we are both connected to the Supreme Soul, one ray, another ray. Therefore, we're brother and sister, or brother and brother, or sister and sister. And when we feel our relationship with everyone, then there is no need to be attached to anything and everyone. Because, and here's the most important thing, that when we have that attachment to Krishna, when we have that love for Krishna, when we have that surrender to Krishna, as Krishna says, as they surrender unto me, I reward them accordingly. Everyone follows my path in all respects. I reward them. What does he reward them with? He rewards them with himself. He gives them his love. And when Krishna reciprocates with that love, the devotee feels transcendental bliss, transcendental peace, transcendental knowledge, transcendental faith, transcendental confidence. He feels truly happy, truly fulfilled. So that is the nature of bhakti yoga in its highest level. And one wants to, because one is getting such a taste, such pleasure, such joy, such happiness from within, the natural expression of that is that just as Krishna is giving his love all over the world, everywhere, just as he's doing that, the devotee also feels a tremendous surge of that same love and wants to share it, wants to give it, wants to spread it, wants to get it into everyone's ear and eye and nose and mouth, wants to give prasadam everywhere. That's the nature of divine love. It spreads itself, it distributes itself. And that's why so many devotees are so ecstatic when they are going out and doing book distribution. Because they are giving the love of God to so many people, whether the person is indifferent or not. That's, of course, sometimes you get somebody very sweet, and it's nice to have a nice conversation with them. But the main point is that you feel in your heart, you're giving something that they will prosper by eternally. You're giving them real life. You're giving them real love. You're giving them the means, the way that they can become truly Krishna conscious. And if they become Krishna conscious soon or later on in life or in the next life, you've made the most wonderful contribution. And Krishna is pleased. He's so satisfied that you have taken the trouble, the time, that you have given up your own sense pleasure to give pleasure to Krishna. That is the true goal of life. Now today is Thanksgiving. Not for the turkeys. They're definitely not saying thank you. 275 million turkeys are killed each year. So they're not saying thanks. And most of them are being killed just within the past month. Originally, Thanksgiving started out, because this connects, it originally started out as a holy day. A holy day is a day you set aside, you consecrate it for the worship and the gratitude to the Supreme Lord. That was the original purpose that it had. In the early 1600s, the Church of England ruled, and they had a very specific agenda, and everyone had to follow this agenda. And it was a rather watered-down version of Christianity, made up mostly of Protestantism. But there were persons who felt that they wanted to follow Jesus, they wanted to follow Christ in a very faithful way, just the way it is in the scriptures. They wanted Bible readings regularly, they wanted preaching regularly, they wanted more focus upon the development of virtues and ethics and things of that sort. They wanted more focus upon the glorification of God. They wanted more of what it originally was. But in the Church of England, they had it in a certain way which was unappealing to certain people who were called the word that comes to my mind is purist, but that's not what the word is. It's a Puritans. Yes. So these were the Puritans, and they wanted it pure. So what happens is that in their efforts to form a sect of Puritans, this was not acceptable to the... By the way, the church and state were the same in that particular day. They didn't have separation of church and state in England at that time. The Church of England was the state church, and it was ruled by a combination of statesmen and clerics or priests. Anyway, what happened was that because this represented a threat to the status quo, a proclamation was issued, and anyone who was caught holding services with these ideas of so-called greater purity. Actually, it was not so-called, it was real greater purity, but in their mind it was so-called, would be arrested, persecuted, tried, and executed. This is what, there was not, so in other words, religious freedom, there was not. You had to obey the Church of England, and this was backed up by the King of England at that time. Anyway, what happened was that eventually the executions were stopped. Nonetheless, those persons who were considered Puritans were looked down upon. They were condemned. There was hostility towards them. They were ridiculed. They were mocked. They did not have a comfortable place to stay. Just as we are here today, we walk out on the street, there's no problems. But when they walked on the street, people jeered at them. People called them words of unbefitting and hostile. Consequently, they wanted to have a place where they could go and not have that. In other words, they wanted religious freedom. So they got on the Mayflower and they sailed across the ocean in 2 months or so. And after they did, they settled, I think they was at, they got on Plymouth Rock, Massachusetts, and they set up communities there. The first year that they were there, so many people starved to death because they didn't really know how to live in the forest. But eventually they came in contact with the American Indians. The American Indians showed them different ways, where to find food, what kind of food you have to have for the winter times, how it can tide you over, how to grow certain things, how to hunt. So they learned, they had a good relationship with the American Indians because the Indians knew that these particular people were kind-hearted and were nonviolent, and therefore there was a nice relationship. Anyway, what happened was that that summer, they had what was called a bumper crop. And because by a bumper crop means that they were, all the crops grew tremendously, they had so much that they had enough to store for the winter so that they would have enough food to last them. Things like beans and wheat and millet and barley, things that you can store in the cold and utilize them through the process of heating and boiling. So they had a bumper crop. Therefore, in November, they decided that why don't we thank God for giving us this wonderful bounty? After all, so many of us starved to death in the past winter. Now God is giving us an opportunity to go on and develop our community because we have enough food. So they designated this a day of thanks. As years went on, George Washington himself proclaimed one of the Thursdays to be a day of thanks. So he recommended to everyone in the country to give thanks on that one day. And then Abraham Lincoln designated that the fourth Thursday of every November should be designated as Thanksgiving, so that the whole country would give thanks to God for, again, the crops, the bounty, and all the good things that were coming. And then in 1940 or so, it was enacted by Congress that Thanksgiving would be a legal holiday. Now, it no longer was a holy day. It became a holiday. A holiday means time for fun, time for play, time for sense pleasure, time for frolicking, time for getting off from work for 4 days, getting out of school for 4 days, no work, all play, lots of fun. So this is the idea. And of course, there was so much distraction. Even in the 1940s, we had radio and we had magazines and we had sports events and things of this sort. So persons would, particularly today, people on Thanksgiving, you know, you have your big turkey dinner, and the big turkey is there. If you ever looked up on Google how the turkeys are slaughtered, you would never even want to. It would just make your stomach turn. It's abominable, actually, how anybody could even do this. So anyway, the persons today, what they'll do, the way it's honored, is it's a day or actually a weekend of sense pleasure. Let's stuff the turkey down till it's up to here, till you can't even get up from the table and waddle away. You're so tired and so listless, your head just falls down on the table until somebody wakes you up. I used to have contests with my cousin. We used to have eating contests. We were no more than 7 or 8 years old, and she always beat me, because she was naturally fat and she was always overeating, so her stomach was big enough to hold it all. But anyway, the important thing is that it was just a thing of sense pleasure, sense gratification. But the real meaning of Thanksgiving, it's a time to thank the Lord. But we in Krishna consciousness don't thank the Lord one day of year, or one month or one month out of the whole year. Or 1 week out of the whole year. Our business, as we have learned from Srila Prabhupada and our great acharyas, every moment is to be a moment of thanks. Here we are sitting, the ceiling is not falling in. Nobody's busting into the door and saying, "All right, put your hands up." Whereas it is done in some of the Eastern European countries. We're free. We have freedom of religion. And it could be taken away if we don't fully appreciate it, if we don't give thanks for it, if we don't realize that Krishna is giving us food. We have to think about this. It's not just, you know, he feeds us today. He clothes us. He shelters us. He gives us medications when it's necessary. Gives us sunlight. Gives us air. All these things which we naturally take for granted. And the question is, do I deserve them? The answer is no, I don't deserve them. When I consider all my offenses and all my sins and all my wrongs, I deserve to be kicked and kicked and kicked and kicked. But Krishna, out of his causeless mercy, hears me say, "Well, I'll try to be better. I'll try to do good. I'll try to serve you." Ah, okay. I take away your karmic reactions. I forget all your sins and I just go ahead. It's like you never did anything wrong. But we ourselves have to remember that we did something wrong. We offended Krishna. And in some degree, like any father, he feels hurt. Hurt in the sense that he's detached, yes. But that we drifted away from him. And he loves the relationship between his children and himself. So as a result, it is good. That's why, as Fawas was mentioning in the class so nicely yesterday, austerity is so important. Austerity is a way of saying, I did some wrong, Krishna, and I want to make it up. I want to make amends. So I'll take a little of the pain that I should get, which you're not giving me. And in so doing, I'm trying to put teeth in my regret, teeth in my sorrow. So please accept this as an offering in the sense that I recognize you are giving me so much mercy, so much love, so much kindness. I don't deserve it, but I want to at least try to deserve it. And I know I never will deserve it, but I can at least try and show you that I have a little tiny itsy-bitsy bit of worthiness. And Krishna sees that and sees it much differently. He sees any effort that we're making as large, as great, as humongous, as tremendous. Oh, this person was a sinner. He was a wrongdoer. Look, he's making, or she's making so much wonderful effort, getting up early in the morning, dressing the deity, myself, my brother and my sister, going out on Harinam, distributing books. How wonderful this is. I will do everything I can to bless him or her so that he or she can come back to me faster and faster. This is Krishna's mood. But when we realize that we owe so much, it's so motivating. It urges us. It pushes us on to work harder, stronger, more intensely. And remember the blessings that Krishna has given us. And to try to give back what we never can really give back. Because what Krishna gives us is so vast, so amazing, astounding. What we give him is so tiny, small, and insignificant. Nonetheless, that's what makes him so wonderful, so glorious, and so much to be appreciated. Thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Thank you so much. Bhagavatam ki jai. Any questions for those who are staying? Any comments or anything you'd like to make? Happy Thanksgiving.